Make your fall fabulous at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Do all the things you've wanted to do all summer, all day, all night. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.
Hello and welcome to Mountain Comics. I'm your host, Rob Kelly, and this is the show where I look back at the comic books I bought while on vacation in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania in the 1970s and 1980s. Joining me this month in the cabin is our pal, Terry O'Malley. Hi, Terry.
September, October, November. A vacation you'll always remember. Hello, Rob.
Hello.
It's so great to be here at the cabin. I've been looking forward to this for such a long time. It's an honor to be invited.
Oh, absolutely. I would love it if your band would cover that little Poconos jingle or something. That would be fantastic. So, this month we're here to talk about Batman number 365, which was on sale August 11th, 1983, just a few days shy of my 12th birthday. And of course, Terry, we're going to find out from you if you have any sort of like Mountain Comics in your background. But first, we have to thank our sponsor. This episode of Mountain Comics is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 45% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Terry, what you got?
I have got, because I wanted to get something that was drawn by the artist of this month's book, the great, inimitable, and dearly missed Don Newton.
Mm-hmm.
So I've chosen New Gods hardcover. This is a collection that includes first issue special number 13, The New Gods numbers 12 through 19, Adventure Comics 459 and 460, DC Special Series number 10, Super Team Family number 15, and Justice League of America number 183 through 185. So this not only gives you a bunch of Don Newton, you also get a little Dick Dillon and George Perez at the end. And this is the story. Now, for you youngsters out there listening to Mountain Comics, actually, if you're listening to Mountain Comics, you're probably an old guy like
that. Yeah, I'm like, what youngster is listening to this, Terry?
This collection is the Dark Side story conclusion. At the end of the story, Dark Side is destroyed forever and doesn't come back for 1,000 years. So any comic book you have seen after Justice League of America number 185, circa, what,
1980, actually.
That long ago. Oh, 1980. Yep. Okay. Yeah. Darkseid hasn't appeared since.
That's awesome. I can't believe they're leaving such a huge villain just in the background like that.
Because he's only for this one story. This is his milieu. He doesn't belong anywhere else. He doesn't care about anything else except anti-life. And once he's defeated, he's defeated.
Don Newton on paper is such a weird choice for New Gods, you know, like, and yet he could do anything, you know, the guy could really do anything.
I remember, when the book was canceled, New Gods was canceled, and they finished the story in Adventure Comics, and it was still, Conway and Newton, but there are a couple of panels in that Adventure Comics, just a couple of books, but these two panels are just seared in my memory of how good they are. And it's Darkseid extending his hand to Orion and then closing his fist in the next panel. And Newton, I don't think he took many shortcuts. And you know, a lot of artists will do, you know, if we're repeating a scene, repeating an image for effect, they'll, you know, make a photocopy of it. That's fine. But the way I remember it, it's not just the hand that changes. It's a very subtle facial expression change as well. And it's just terrific. And we're going to see a lot of that in this issue.
Absolutely. Did you do the price? How much of this?
Oh, the price, of course. It was $49.95. And in-stock trade price is $28.99. You save 42% hardcover. That's a bargoon right there.
That is a great deal. That is a fantastic pick, because I love Don Newton. And yeah, we're going to be waxing his car throughout this episode, I'm sure. So, I wanted to tie, of course, my pick into something related to this comic. And I was shocked to learn with Modern Comics that DC no longer publishes Batman in any way. Wait, I'm sorry. I wrote that incorrectly. They do nothing but Batman.
Only Batman.
Only. I'm sorry. I wrote that wrong. Apparently DC does nothing but Batman comics nowadays. And I was like, look, do we really need to promote more Batman? I mean, I love the character like anybody else, but does anybody need to be recommended a Batman comic on InstuckTreats.com? So I went another way and I decided to pick another comic set in the jungle. In this case, Tarzan of the Apes hardcover volume 1. This is by Roy Thomas and Pablo Marcus. And this collects something I did not know existed. Apparently on the Edgar Rice Burroughs website, and you had to be a subscriber to this thing, there was an all original Sunday Tarzan strip by Roy Thomas and Pablo Marcus. I had no idea. I'd never heard of this thing. And so we've got it collected here by Dark Horse. It's 136 pages. It's in the horizontal format, so you get the shape of those classic Sunday comics pages. And again, it's by Pablo Marcus and Roy Thomas. And we all know how much Roy Thomas loves Tarzan. So yeah, this is, I never even heard of this thing. And it's collected here in the first volume. I mentioned it's 136 pages. It's a hardcover. The normal price is $29.99, but in stock trades price is $19.19. You save 36%. So that is an awesome deal, as is the New Gods. So So for these and all the other trade paperback needs, visit InStuckTrades.com. And we thank them for their support. Okay, Terry, as I mentioned at the top of the show, this is your first time on Mountain Comics, so I'm going to ask you, do you have something like this in your background? Did you go on any sort of vacations as a kid, a regular place, different places? Is anything like this from your childhood?
Oh, Rob, yes. This is why I am a comic book fan.
Mm.
We used to go to a house up in Western Maine, up near your pal. I forgot his name.
Corey Land.
Yep. My mother's best friend from college and her husband bought a house and land in Maine in the late 60s. So it cost like, you know, $75 for 60 acres.
Oh, dear God.
This was, it was an old farmhouse with a barn attached.
Wow.
And because it's in Maine, there was a series of sheds connecting the house to the barn. So one never had to go outside in the wintertime. If you're going to the barn to take care of the animals, or actually he had to go to the barn because that's what the two holder was for the outhouse.
Oh.
So when they bought this house, there was no plumbing in it. And I remember as a little kid, the pump in the kitchen, but very quickly, this fellow who owned the house and my dad did a lot of work plumbing it, fixing stuff, you know, straightening doors and walls and fixing the roof and all sorts of stuff like that. In fact, when my dad was out of work for a little while, this friend hired him to work on the house up there. So they would go up many weekends, even in the wintertime, to get work done on the house. And we would go up as many weekends as we could in the summertime. Sometimes we could even stay for a week, and the other family was there a lot as well. But, you know, the friends of that family sort of shared the house, and, you know, there was a schedule. I imagine it must have been a schedule because we weren't all there at the same time unless it was deliberate. So I started going there, I don't know, sorry, about 7 or 8 years old. And so there were three kids in my family, and there are four kids in the other family. And this house, this beautiful house, this whole farmhouse is on a dirt road up in the hills of Western Maine. The nearest neighbor was about a quarter mile away. The next neighbor was another mile away. It was hard to get to because you had to get off the real road and get onto a rutted dirt road and then take a fork up the hill through the trees. So it was just completely isolated. And the big treat for us kids was when a grown-up was going to go to town to get the groceries at the market. But there was a general store in town, and it's called the Buckfield General Store.
Classic.
it was classic. It was the best. So especially on a Sunday morning where they had to get the Boston Sunday Globe, still a very important part of my life. So we all get in the car, truck on down to the general store. The grown-ups would get the paper, some food for the week, you know, get their wine and beer. And us kids will go right to the comic book stacks. So this is what, 73, 74, 75, 76, and there. Comics are 20 cents, 25 cents. We were all little kids. So we got, and we shared them. You bought a comic book that you wanted to get if you could, you know, get a quarter out of your old man.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody got a, so if everybody gets a comic, we got, you know, we get three comics, they get four comics if we're all together, but the comics stayed there. So this family went up a lot and they went to town every week or so and these kids would buy comics. So there's a big stack of comics up at the house, mostly Archie. Archie and little Archie. I love little Archie. The Harveys, little Dot, little Lotta. And of course, Richie Rich.
75 Richie Rich yeah. titles.
And a couple of superheroes. No monsters, no apes, not any spooky stuff that I remember. There's mostly the funny stuff. No Disney. I don't remember any of that stuff. It was the Harveys and the Archies. And again, mostly the Archies. But that's where I got some superhero comics in me. And there are some that stayed in my head. And when I started collecting, long after I stopped collecting, and I still go to the comic shop for a very special issue. Those are things that I bought 40 years later because I still remember them. But it was up there, up there in Maine, buying all these comics. I loved comics. But I had no place near my house to get them. The only place I was reading comics was on vacation up in Maine or at these friends, their house in their town next to ours, because they lived near a store that had comics. My house is not near a store that had comics. The nearest
really?
Store
wow.
near my grandparents' house. Yeah. The closest store closed after it was robbed too many times. That was an ice cream shop. And they had a huge thing, but no comics. Oh,
who would rob an ice cream store?
This is the 70s, man. It was tough times.
That's true. Yeah, I guess so. Wow.
But my parents knew I liked comics. So I'm trying to trace the timing back. So it was either Christmas of 1974 or Christmas of 1975 that they gave me Jules Pfeiffer's, great comic book, the great superhero comic book, which had all the Golden Age stories in it. So that was my introduction to a lot of stuff. So I knew about Superman and Batman and Captain Marvel and Captain America and the Human Torch and the Flash and Green Lantern, but all from 1940. And I knew about comics and I like comics and I like superhero comics and I knew about the value of a first issue.
Hmm.
And so sometime in late May or early June of 1976, I was at the general store in Buckfield, Maine. It was probably Memorial Day weekend because that would be the end of May. And I saw a copy of Ragman number one. And I said, yeah, enough of this Richie Rich stuff. This is a number one. This is a superhero. This is something cool. And I bought it. And that's what started my collecting. And within a few weeks, so school would still have been in session. I'm only now figuring this out. So I would go after school on a couple of days, go to the all city band rehearsal for the middle school kids. And then I would walk from the school to my grandparents' house to wait for my mom. And on the way to my grandparents' house was a convenience store and they had comic books. And I hadn't noticed that before. So that became a regular stop. So within a couple of weeks of my buying Ragman number one, I bought Superman number 303 and I was off to the races. I was going to that store every week and trying to figure out which comics I was going to buy with the little money that I had.
That is amazing. That is absolutely amazing. I have just you saying the phrase general store, you know, just gave me that warm feeling of those stores.
Such a great store. You know, the old wooden floors that were wavy and undulating because people had been walking on them for 100 years.
Yep.
That kind of store. It was great.
I wonder how many copies of Ragman they sold up there.
At least one.
Yeah.
And you know, it's weird that, you know, it one of those stores that who knows how long a comic is going to sit there. It's one of those places it could sit there for months, you know?
Yep.
In fact, you do know. You've talked about this at your store. There's comics that just hang around and hang around.
Mm-hmm. That's so cool. Do you still have any of those books, or have they did?
Yes,
appeared over the years? Oh, you do.
I still have Ragman number one.
You really have that? Still have that same copy?
Because that's the one that started. I said, "Wow, I want to buy these and keep these now." There are a couple of Richie Riches they're not part of my official collection. They're sort of in my cast-off box. You know, comics that have no covers, stuff like that.
Okay,
that's a different shopping excursion in my early days. and you know, the Richie Rich, so I, you know, drew mustache on Richie in the cover, stuff like that. But yeah, so that would have been from 75 or so, a couple of those issues. I think some of the Archie digests I have are from back then. And like I said, I had to replace a couple they're in my head. One was Legion of Superheroes. My older sister loved the Legion of Super. She loved Superboy. She thought he was cute. This is Mike Grell drawing the Legion.
He was, sure. Yeah. Mike Grell, yeah, did very attractive people. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And of course, me being a younger brother, you know, I disparaged that, made fun of it. But then when I saw it on sale a few months later after I started collecting, I said, oh, I already know these people, so I'm going to buy this issue. And, but the one I remembered, I bought many, many years later when I was making my Legion collection, when I went back and started buying a lot of stuff I didn't have. But the other one I had to get was an issue of World's Finest from 1974. So I was 10 then. So I read that when I was 10, 11, if it was still hanging around, if it had been burned. We had a wood burning fireplace up there. So a lot of comics got burned, but that comic book had the Superman Batman team up. It had a vigilante story, a Golden Age vigilante story. It had a Rip Hunter story, which was nearly incomprehensible to me. It had a Golden Age Black Canary story. But most important, it had a Silver Age Superman Batman team up with the Olsen Robin team. And that one stuck in my head. Jimmy Olsen and Robin team up and they try to convince the World's Finest duo that they are dead. And so they bury some coffins and put their names on the thing. But the thing that I love the best, but this first of all, is beautiful Kurt Swan art. And Chris Franklin backed me up on that. but the whole crux of the story was, you know, Olsen and Jimmy and Robin think they have the old guys tricked. But as soon as they saw the coffins, Superman looked at him and saw both of their fingerprints on each coffin. So he knew it was a fake.
I mean, he also had X-ray vision, too.
Yeah, but they're lead coffins, of course, you know?
Of course.
But that's a smart superhero that I've always liked.
How many years did this go on? How many years did you keep going to Maine and buying comics up there?
Through the 70s. I was looking through Mike's Amazing to see if any of the covers sparked my memory. But by 76, 77, I was buying them in my hometown and bringing them with me to Maine. I have a couple of issues of Action and Detective Comics that have really wrinkled covers because I packed them with my stuff, brought them up. And I remember reading them up there. And so we stopped going up regularly in the early 80s. I don't remember. Oh, my mom was still going up. She would spend time up there. But by then, 82, I graduated high school.
Yeah, right. Okay. So, yeah. That's usually the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Now you have a job and stuff. So I can't go. It's not a family thing anymore.
Yep.
Yeah, so that was so, but probably 1980-81 was the last time we went up as a family. I went up to visit many times afterward, but it wasn't long after that. The general store got some videotapes and
wow!
The comics were gone.
Oh, really? They were gone. They disappeared while you were still kind of going there.
No, after regular going, but going back.
I see. Okay. I gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Oh, man.
The general store. Oh, it's all different now. Oh, there are no comics anymore.
Man. I wonder what's there now. I mean, certainly not a general store, probably.
I think it's still a general store. Actually, you know what? I don't know. I'm guessing. It's a good location for a store, for a convenience store.
I mean, they still do exist. They're certainly rarefied. you know, nowadays, but they still do exist. When my wife and I were in California on our honeymoon, and we went up to Point Reyes for a little side trip, and we needed to stop at a, we needed like a charger for our phone. Yep. And we went through this little town, and there was like the town's general store. And it, it was like what you were talking about, except this had like a cement floor, but we went in there and it was huge. I mean, they had everything. They had phone chargers and all sorts of stuff.
Wow.
And then, you know, nobody, it's so funny. She'll say to me like, oh, maybe they have comics. I'm like, no, they don't, because they're not being distributed that way anymore. Even if the general store wanted to carry them, they can't get them. And, you know, it's just like, oh, this makes me sad. And it makes me, every time when I go to a store like that, when I look at a general store that's clearly been there for decades, I'm like, yeah, I wonder where the comics used to be in this place.
Yeah.
You know, they were somewhere.
Well, the place I used to go to is still a little store. It's a little convenience store and coffee house, a coffee bar, a coffee service. They have coffee, I guess. I haven't been inside in 40
years. They serve a beverage called coffee.
Yeah, yeah. But when I, every time I drive by, which is almost daily, I, you know, glance over at it and I think it was so much bigger. How did they have that huge shelf of newspapers and magazines? It was a big, yeah, it was a big, wasn't a spinner. Spinner rack was at the other store, McGee's. Kiffin just had a big, huge magazine rack.
Oh,
and that was right next to the door. Oh, yeah. And oh, first of all, I'm going to ask, remember the thrill of the hunt?
Yep.
Hey, a little store. I wonder if they have comics.
They have Ragman for pizza.
Yeah. But the other part was, maybe you felt this way too. I think you did, actually. You talked about this a lot. Going in, there's the big rack of comics and magazines, and those are biker mags.
Right.
Those are teenage mags. Oh, those are men's mags. I can't be seen looking. I don't even want to look at, I want to look at them, but I can't be seen looking at them. I'll get in trouble for looking at them.
Heavy
I'm
metal.
I'm not looking at the biker mags. I'm looking at these comics.
Heavy metal looks like a comic, but it's got stuff I probably shouldn't be looking at, but it, I don't know. Feels like a comic. These Warrens. I don't know. Going to be buying these?
Oh, the Warrens. Yeah. I didn't want to touch those.
Yeah. I'd love to. I had to sneak them into the house, but I absolutely love them. Well, that's fantastic, Terry. That is so awesome. I am very, I'm going to say I'm envious because I had the same experience, but I'm happy that you had a similar experience, because I think it is, it's the reason I do the show. I think it's a special thing.
This is why I really love this show. Because every time I listen to it every time, it brings you back to those wonderful halcyon days of reading comics in the sunshine and going to getting another one. Rainy days, go out to the shed and find a stack of comics. All right, I read this 15 times, right? I'm going to read it again.
Yeah, read it again. Sure. Yeah. Oh,
there's
yeah.
A stack over there that I never read at all.
Richie Rich's. I was like,
stupid. I'll read those.
Richie Rich's Billions or whatever. I'll get to that one last. Well,
sad sack comics. Who likes those?
Nobody with any taste. No. Don't worry. He's not listening to this. So, well, that is awesome, Terry. I love that story so much. Makes me so happy. So, all right. Let's talk about Batman, everybody.
Batman.
As I mentioned, it's Batman number 365. It was on sale August 11th, 1983. Like I said, it was just a few days shy of turning 12 at this point. The story is called Ruins by Doug Mensch. I never know how to say that right. Is it that? Okay, yeah. I feel like every time I say it, I get it wrong. Don Newton, which we've already talked about, and Alfredo Alcala. Before I get to the synopsis, though, let's talk about this cover by Ed Hannigan and Dick Giordano. I feel like, look, this show can't help but sometimes come across as like old man yells at cloud, where it's like, you know, oh, I wish modern comics looked like this nowadays. And they can't, because times change and whatever. That said, could DC publish a Batman comic with a cover like this simple? Like, I don't mean simple in terms of the drawing. The drawing is fantastic. But this basic, it's like, hey, it's Batman in the jungle. That's it. Yeah. That's all you need to know. I mean, obviously, there's more story to it, but there's no hint of that on this cover other than Vicki Vale getting attacked by a cheetah. But, like, it's just Jungle Jeopardy. That's it. That's all you need. Here, kids, fork over 60 cents. Could they do that now? I don't think that. It would have to be like, oh, look, the Mad Hatter is ripping his skin off or whatever crazy shit they're doing. It's just been like Batman's taking on a bunch of jungle natives. Boom. Yeah. That's your comic. But what do you think of this as a cover?
I agree with you, except that I think this cover is too busy and it's really hard to focus on anything. especially with the colors. There are a lot of reds and oranges. And so things like Batman's cape and cowl, even though Batman's head is center of the book, of the cover, it doesn't really pop out. He's fighting what looks like to be some sort of tribal chieftain who has a big white headdress thing, and he's got a huge nose ring and three earrings in his ear and a necklace with like the Tyrannosaurus teeth and a medallion on it. And he's holding some sort of blade or cricket bat or something. And Batman's got his wrist, and he's got Batman's other wrist, and there are two spears coming right at Batman, and two more native fighters behind him, and the cheetah leaping at Vicky over on the right side of the page. But it just feels like, with the coloring of the trees, the very muted leaves in the back, the coloring of the vines around the trees, the coloring of the cheetah, the coloring of the skin tones, the coloring of the spear tips and the spears. There's too much of a sameness there for me. I just think it's just a little too busy.
Okay, fair enough. It is that the composition is a little, there's a kind of a lot of dead space right under like the Batman logo where the rock is and stuff.
Yeah.
So maybe bat, like I could imagine it would be, you could tilt it a little bit where you tilt it, say 30 degrees counterclockwise to where Batman's head is more in that space. And that turns your eye a little more rather than that he's sort of down in the right hand side. But to be fair to Ed Hannigan, who was a great cover designer, he was probably designing 30 covers for DC that month. And so he was like, you know, good, you know,
I hadn't looked it up. I didn't realize it was Ed Hannigan. I should have known. I think it just looks like a Rich Buckler cover to me.
You know, it's so funny. For the longest time, I thought it was either Rich Buckler or perhaps Walt Simonson inked by somebody else. Mm. I looked it up on Mike's Amazing World, and it says Ed Hannigan and Dick Giordano.
So I don't doubt normally, it. Normally, it's very Buckler-esque. But the thing about Ed Hannigan, man, someone should do a retrospective about him, because his covers for DC at this time were just absolutely magnificent.
Yeah,
and great covers of Peter Parker's Spectacular Spider-Man. Holy mackerel, what great layouts, every single one. And he'd mess around with the logos as well. What a genius he was.
And also says something about, and I don't know whether they still do it this way anymore, but like the importance that comic book companies placed on the cover, that they would have a separate cover artist, a cover designer, who would, you know, for the most part, design the covers for the entire line.
Yeah.
Any given month, Carmen Infantino did that at one point. Nick Carty did that. I mean, that was a they realized to separate kids from their dimes and their quarters.
Gil Kane did the Marvel all through the mid-70s.
Gil Kane, right. Yeah. Nobody, by the way, I will die on this hill. Nobody beat Marvel's covers in the 70s. Marvel covers are just chef's kiss. As much as DC had great covers, every Marvel cover I see on Twitter or Facebook, I'm just like, these things are just designed within an inch of their lives. They're just so exciting.
Despite those boxes.
Despite all those boxes and stuff. Well, this 70s is pre, you could win this Schwinn nonsense on the top. So is that at least. But again, it's just something so simple about this. Jungle Jeopardy. Like, okay, great. And, you know, unlike a lot of the other books that I would mention on Mountain Comics, where I would buy it because I was at the Poconos and I needed more reading material. So I was buying something that I would not normally buy, or I was buying something I couldn't normally find at home. Batman was one of my regular purchases.
Yeah.
All the time. It was, you know, one, I never missed it. So this was one that just, oh, okay, this is this month's Batman, and I happen to be up in the Poconos. Let me get it. So
yeah, I was a regular Batman reader too. So by this point, I had been getting every issue of Batman for the previous 7 years.
Yeah, that's about where I was at this point. When I think about it, this is 83. Maybe I wasn't at 7 years, but I was buying Batman regularly from like 79 past the first movie, past the 89 movie. So you're talking 10 solid years of buying Batman every single month.
I'll talk more about that later.
Okay. All right.
I was a regular Batman reader.
All right. Yeah. Man, I'm me too.
About my Batman.
Recently over on Twitter, Tim Price has been posting Batman covers he's been reading, and those are all like they're a little bit after this, but that's my jam. I'm like, these are, oh man, these covers, you know, Black Mask and all that, you know, Batman number 400. Like, this is my stuff, man. These are all this stuff. So I love this comic. So anyway, the plot synopsis is as such: in a small village in Guatemala, investigative reporter Vicky Vale is on the trail of a delivery of Russian arms on their way to some local rebels. Suddenly, a group of these same rebels draw their weapons and redirect the equipment to a new set of trucks. Vale can't make sense of this, but she continues to follow. Meanwhile, Bruce Wayne and young Jason Todd board a train in Indiana headed for Gotham City. Jason is full of youthful excitement over his new life as Batman's junior partner, but Bruce is filled with doubt over the promise he has made to the young boy. Back in Guatemala, Vicky has stowed aboard one of the trucks and followed it back to a camp. She goes looking for clues as to what is happening, only to find herself with rifles pointed at her. After a brief interlude back in Gotham, we see that Vicky is in a dank cell being watched by a mysterious purple-gloved man. When a guard comes in to deliver some food, she uses her camera to knock him out and escape. Overnight, she finds her way to a small village, but no one there speaks English. The goons catch up to her and march her back, but not before Vicky drops a crumpled up note she wrote in her cell into the lap of a visiting tourist. We then see that the mysterious figure in charge knows about this and hoped that this is exactly what she would do. Bruce and Jason have arrived at Wayne Manor, and when he gets a call from a tearful Barbara Gordon telling him that Commissioner Gordon has had a stroke and is in the hospital. While visiting, Bruce is told by Harvey Bullock about a message that came into the GCPD all the way from Guatemala about Vicky Vale being in some sort of trouble. That night, Bruce suits up as Batman, and Jason argues he wants to come along. Batman says no, but promises that when he returns, Jason will get his chance. He takes off in the Batplane. Batman then lands in Guatemala, only to find a series of death traps waiting for him, including a hail of bullets, landmines, and a gaggle of Indians armed to the teeth. He survives and finds a crude drawing of himself in the loincloth of one of his attackers. Batman finds the camp and dodges the attack of a cheetah. He uses some crude distraction tactics on the guards, which work. Batman then sneaks into the camp, only to fall through a trapdoor into a large throne room decorated with giant squirting flowers and playing cards. Uh-oh. Yes, of course, that means the Joker, who has Vicky Vale bound and gagged, about to order his gang of armed henchmen to open fire on Batman. To be continued.
Yeah.
Woo. Okay, Terry, overall thoughts on this issue?
Terrific. Love it.
All right, we're done. Thanks for listening, everybody. It was great.
That's the overall, yeah.
Yeah. No, this is a... I had not read this comic in a little while. I don't know if the copy that I have here in my collection is the same one from actually buying it in 1983. Probably not. It's in pretty good shape. Oh. I think most of my mountain comics are a little more good to fair condition than the one I've got here, but yeah, this was such a blast to read again, and that it's obviously part of a continued story, you know, but it also is a complete meal. It's got a beginning, middle, and end, which I find to be very satisfying, and I'm sure at 12 years old, I would have found it satisfying too, because it's a complete Batman adventure with a great, I was going to say hook at the end. It's a hook to buy the next issue. It's not a hook because it's not a surprise, because Menick layers it in early who the villain is watching all of this.
But he hasn't been seen in quite a while. So it's a nice.
That's right. Back then.
It was back then. It wasn't every 6 hours. Yeah.
He didn't have his own title and movie at that point. The splash page, which
this book had been canceled long ago.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the 70s one. The splash page, which I will post on the gallery post accompanying.
It is exquisite.
Oh man, Alfredo Wakala is an inker that we have talked about on other episodes, and Chris has talked about it on some of his shows and stuff like that. About Alfredo Wakala is a very dominating inker. He really takes over whoever he pencils, and sometimes the penciler can get lost. Sometimes it's really hard to recognize the work. In this case, not so much. You know, this is Don Newton. It's got a heavy layer of Wakala over it, but it is clearly Don Newton. Again, this opening splash of Batman looming over the jungle, reminiscent of that classic cover from the 30s where he's looming on the mountain, and then Neil Adams did his own version of it in the 70s. Again, this is my Batman, you know?
Yes,
mine too. He's moody. He's the Dark Knight. He's not a sociopath, but he's also the Grim Avenger of the night. I just love this opening image.
He's grim. He's serious, and he's smart. That's what I like. This I like Batman in this issue a lot. And when I was reading it, one thing I really loved that Alcala does with Newton is Batman's face is never fully lit, and rarely is it fully shown. Even here on the splash page, it's a great image that's it's referencing a very, very early Batman or detective comic from 1939.
Yep.
That the looming face and cape and cowl. He's got a serious look about him, and his face under the cowl is visible from the right side, but the left is almost completely in shadow. It's got that beautiful, what is that technique of that? It's, you know, the semi shadow there on his jawline.
Mm-hmm.
It's just magnificent how that's done.
Yeah. It's a really, again, I love splash pages, you know,
and the detail that Alcala puts in the rest of the splash on the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Leaves, the gnarled bark on the trees, the petals on the flowers, the mountains. It must have taken him days.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Him at Newton was, presumably Newton did all the pens, put all this line work in there, and then Alcala had to ink it. But I mean, good Lord, we know that stories about Don Newton. The guy drove himself kind of to an,
He drove himself to death.
I mean, he just worked so hard and poured so much work into his pages. And again, you can see it with this kind of image. It's just really beautifully, lushly rendered. It's just an absolutely marvelous image, and it sets the tone for the story. And by the way, you know, this is kind of a fun, we don't get to see Batman in the jungle that much.
Right.
You know, that's another thing, is this is him removed from his classically urban setting into a jungle, and they wouldn't necessarily think it would work, but it's moody and all, everything else.
And then kudos for it being a South American jungle, which is rare in these adventure stories.
Yeah, totally. So then we get this opening sequence with Vicki Vale, intrepid, photojournalist. You have to assume that this is bringing Vicki Vale back into the Batman continuity had to be the reason she ends up in the movie just a couple of years later.
Yeah.
And it's not Silver St. Cloud, although that was a treatment at some point.
No, but, no, Steve. Vicky's been around for several years at this point.
Has she been really?
Yes. She's been around for months and months and months and months. Her relationship with Bruce Wayne is over. That's about the writing ticks I'll complain about later. But that's why she is in South America. She had to get out of Gotham.
Ah, okay. All right. I'll have to go back and read the other ones. Like I said, I remember she was in it for a while.
I did go back and reread because I reread this, and I wanted to say, oh, what happens next? Right. What happened just before?
So then we get the scene where Bruce and Jason Todd are in Indiana.
The real
Jason Todd. I love the idea that multimillionaire Bruce Wayne is taking a train all the way from Indiana to Gotham City. Like, that seems like a kind of not great use of his time, considering he's Batman. Like, just get on your private jet and fly to Gotham City. Yeah, I mean, I know part of it, he wants to spend time with Jason, but it does
seem... Here's another pin to put in about my... The writing ticks.
Okay. I mean, how many Justice League meetings is he missing?
Yeah.
By being on this train for like however many days is this kid missing? Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So then we get back to Vicky. There's a marvelous sequence where she stumbles onto this camp and she's wondering, like, oh, geez, I'm trying to find some clues. And then there's just this beautifully colored page, panel of her in the spotlight where she is in solid yellow with a red spotlight, and that's in two panels in a row, and it's great. It's beautiful.
Wow. Yeah, Newton Alcala draw an absolutely beautiful Vicki Vale. And this whole page from her alighting on the truck, there's a graceful motion to her body as she swings out of the back of this truck. A wonderfully detailed truck, which is not drawing focus, going into a wonderfully detailed pyramid structure. Again, not drawing focus. And I'm pointing that out because there are a lot of things about this time, especially just a few years later, a couple of artists who annoy me because they went to excessive detail, which drew my eye away from the central figure who's supposed to be, we're talking about in the panel. Because of just the way it was done. This way, it's all part of one thing. Your eye is moving across and just taking everything in. The scene is filled. And then the next tier, the three panels, Vicky in shadow. We don't see her face. She's peering over that wall. Look how nice that arm is. Very simple. That line work and just on the bend of the arm, the inner bend. It's so simple. And then the spotlight hits her and we can see her face full and her eyes wide, her mouth's open, and she's spinning around in shock. It's just magnificent.
Yeah. And we should mention this issue was colored by Adrian Roy, longtime DC colorist. And she just does an absolutely terrific job here. That's just a great sequence. And so we go back to Gotham City. There's a brief interlude back in a hospital where Commissioner Gordon has had a stroke and he's being visited by Harvey Bullock, who's talking to Gordon. And one of the traits of Bullock was that he was a bull in a china shop. So while he's talking to Gordon, he swings his arm and he knocks a vase of flowers onto the ground and it smashes and Gordon is unconscious. So he doesn't see any of this. And we see that, you know, Bullock is sort of like, okay, you know, like a kind of, if he had lived and if Harvey Bullock had ever appeared in a Batman comic, you could see like a James Gandolfini kind of playing this part, this rumpled guy. And he sort of shuffles off because he feels bad that, it, you know, he broke the vase.
So he didn't break the vase. He's knocked over because then he bends down and picks up the flowers.
Oh, yeah, you're right. No, you're right. It's not broken. Right. He just knocks it. He just knocks it onto the ground. That's right.
And
I'm
pointing that out because it's significant because this is the turning point for the Harvey Bullock character, who was brought in editorially and in the story to be an annoyance, to annoy the reader and to annoy Commissioner Gordon because he's a political tool of the mayor. And at this point, this is genuine remorse. And he's being his clumsy self and knocking the flowers over. And then with these two silent panels, picking them back up and putting them back where they belong. And he's never done that before. He knocks stuff over. He leaves stuff around. He spills food everywhere. That's what we've been seeing for several months.
Oh, okay.
But now this is really where he's going to turn. And that becomes more apparent in the next couple of issues.
Very cool. I like that. Good catch. So then we're back in Guatemala and we see that Vicky is being watched by a closed circuit camera. So obviously this camp that she's in is not quite as unsophisticated as it might look in the first place. And we see there is a hand talking to the guy operating the camera and the hand is in a purple sleeve with a purple glove. And we see the wrist and it is
white.
Chalk white. So. Yep. There we go.
Nice job, Adrian. That's beautiful.
Yeah, we all, you know, we know who it is at this point. So, okay. Vicky makes this little scribble and we can't exactly see what she's writing. And then the guy comes in to bring her some food. And, which actually, I'm genuinely surprised the Joker would even bother to give her food, you know, to be honest with you. It's a little nicer than
you got to keep your hostage alive. That's the whole point of having a hostage.
I guess, but I mean, you know, you could starve her. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, what difference does it make?
No, but we'll find out why in just a couple of seconds.
Well, yes, he's doing this so we can lure Batman there, but I'm just saying you could feed her a little bit over the, you know, for like a couple of days and just enough to keep her alive. But like we see on the plate, it's like a full meal. Like there's like a vegetable and
some mosler or something there.
Yeah. I mean, come on. You know, I've had worse breakfast
burrito.
Some hotels, you know, have not been this good. So she decides to sacrifice her camera for the greater good and uses it and hits the she twirls it and then she grabs the tray and hits the guy, knocks him out. There's a great little inset panel with no borders of her just running out the door, which is just again very very moody. I really like it.
Yeah, and I like how she's got these tight white pants on, this sort of off the shoulder kind of shirt. I remember girls wearing those back then.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Little tiny sleeves, but they're not on her shoulder; they're around her upper arms.
Yeah, it's kind of like a tank top, sort of thing. Tank top don't have sleeves. It's funny that the outfit on the cover she never wears. Again, her in her pith helmet outfit, like she's Congo Bill or something. She never wears that in this outfit. So then she makes it out to this, she makes it out to sort of a camp where, not a camp, she makes it out to where there's a tour bus And she starts talking to the various people visiting, but none of them speak English. And so none of them understand what she's saying. The goons get the drop on her. They come back with guns and they start marching her back. And then she sees a guy sitting on a rock, fidgeting with a camera. She drops a note in his lap. The guy looks at the note. He doesn't speak any English, but he looks at the note.
Because he's Japanese.
Right. He doesn't speak any English. She gives him a look, a worried look, and he kind of nods. And so he understands, like, oh, okay, I know, sort of understand what this is going on. And we think, oh, Vicky's got one over on these guys. And then in the very next panel, we see that was the intention all along. This guy planned that Vicky Vale would do just that.
She got the note off, boss.
Got the note off. So then Bruce Wayne, he's not Batman yet. Again, look at, like, this is page 11. Yeah. And outside of the splash page, we have had no Batman.
Nope.
I don't know if anyone out there listening to this is reading current Batman comics and I am wrong. Please let me know in the comments. Maybe I'm just assuming something, but I feel like nowadays Batman would not go 11 pages in his own book without being Batman. They just would not do that nowadays. But again, maybe I'm wrong. And so we get a call from Barbara Gordon who mentions
up to that panel with the taxi.
Mm-hmm.
See the taxi driver's name?
What is the taxi driver's name?
Bruce Wayne says, keep the change, Jake.
Okay.
Jake Lockley was one of Moon Knight's secret identities.
Oh, really?
who wrote Moon Knight?
Oh, Doug Minich.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right. Oh, okay.
Well, there's a little sneaky crossover right there.
DC Marvel crossover. There we go. Oh, that's great. Oh, I never would have caught that. But yeah, that makes total sense. And yes, the fact that the same guy wrote both characters. You're like, yeah, that's got to be what that is. That's great. That's super. That's awesome. Did they ever do Batman Moon Knight?
I have no idea.
They had to have, right? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer. But anyway, Barbara Gordon calls Bruce, tells him that Commissioner Gordon has had a stroke. He goes to visit Gordon at the hospital, and then this phone call comes in, and the minute Harvey mentions that Bruce Wayne is like, wait a minute, what's the detail? Give me what's happening? And so he finds out what's going on, and, you know, Harvey, of course, is like, you know, well, I don't know why I'm telling this guy. What does he care? Of course, we know why.
Right.
And then we finally get Batman. He's finally dressing up in his bat uniform. Jason wants to go with him, but he's saying, look, you're going to stay behind, but I promise you when I get back, you know, you're going to get the suit up, and we're going to do some training. And there's a funny panel, well, a funny caption at the bottom, right? We see the Batplane taking off from this giant hangar, and it is referred to as a camouflaged hangar.
Hmm.
Is that camouflaged? A giant red barn in a green grassy knoll? Is that camouflaged? I don't.
Giant red barn, Rob. When's the last time you drove by a barn and thought, I bet there's an airplane in there?
I guess when I think of the word camouflage, I think it's colored to blend into its surroundings.
No, it's supposed to look like a barn.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I just wonder about the size of that doorway. What the wingspan is on the Batjet.
That is a big barn. That is a big barn that it can, and we see that, like, there's really no, like, landing strip.
No.
Like, yeah, there are, you know, or runway. The jet, presumably Batman has kind of like that vertical takeoff technology where he can just sort of hover.
Yes.
And then take off, you know, whatever, which is cool.
Long established, though, I think that there was bat aircraft in the barn on Wayne Manor. That goes way back.
Yeah. And if you believe the challenge of the Super Friends, the bat jet can go back in time. The powerful jet. So, Batman lands.
Just listened to it yesterday.
I love it. So Batman lands in Guatemala, and he is immediately met with one death trap after the next to get some bullets fired on him.
Isn't that great?
Oh, man, it's great.
Two pages of bat action, and you never see his face.
I love that bottom panel where his face is completely in shadow and the cape is fluttering. Oh, man, that just looks fantastic. And then the next page, which is colored almost entirely in magenta.
Yes.
It's just gorgeous.
That's terrific stuff.
Yeah. And Batman uses the Batplane as an explosive because this truck is firing at him, and he kind of rigs the Batplane to just take off. And we see that it heads into the truck and blows these guys up now.
And he's already given us the thought balloon of better keep the engines running.
Does Batman kill these guys?
Nope. If you look at that middle panel, you see they're all jumping away from the truck. They're running
away. Okay, sure. Sure.
They're very careful about
it. They all get away. They all got away. Okay, that's fine. So Batman then sees what clearly is a landmine. He can recognize what the ground kind of looks like from there. He uses a rock to set it off so it explodes. He jumps over. He swings. Does like a Tarzan thing where he swings over the explosion. He then sees a dart come flying at him and it hits a tree. And then we get this wonderful full page illustration of a bunch of locals with their machetes attacking Batman coming out of the shadows. And Don Newton was in real life a bodybuilder. That was something that he had a lot of personal interest in. And he was apparently had really like quite an impressive physique for anybody, let alone a comic book artist. And so
an impressive Captain Marvel costume.
Right. And right. Exactly. So this is right. This is his thing, is like this beautiful, wonderfully rendered, muscly anatomy. This is just totally in his ballpark.
Yeah. That's what Batman should look like.
Yeah. Lean, muscly, but lean,
And ready to jump, ready to run, ready to react, not just standing.
Yeah. It's great stuff.
Bent, arms bent, fingers ready to move. Terrific.
Yeah. There's a totally silent page except for some sound effects of Batman taking care of these guys. He uses their weight against each other. He picks one of them up and throws it at the other group. Yep. He knocks one guy out. Another guy misses with like his spear. He grabs a branch and kicks another guy, punches another guy, hits one guy in the neck and sort of knocks him out. And we see
the guy he punches, he's twisted his face around.
that guy's jaw is totally broken.
Yeah,
that guy's eating soft food for the next 6 months. No doubt about that. He's going to be tough living out in the bush, only being able to drink milkshakes or whatever he's got to do there. And I love that we see that a bunch of them have run off, which is great. I love that little detail. Like they're just like, oh yeah, screw this, just take off. And then Batman finds this little piece of paper tucked in the loincloth of one of these guys, and I love this detail where it's a drawing of Batman. And I look at this drawing and it's he even says it's a crude likeness. Yeah. This is what my Batman looked like when I was 12, when I drew it. This is what it looked. Man. It looked like I drew this.
Yeah. if you're lucky, you have some colored pencils.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. But I love it. I just love that little drawing of himself.
I've got my college notebooks as well as high school notebooks in the margins. I got little Batman heads and little green arrow heads because they're fun to draw.
They are. Batman and Spider-Man heads, I find, are the most fun to draw. There's something about the shapes that are just incredibly pleasurable for your hand to go in that particular sort of, strokes or whatever. I think by weather, probably two of the greatest designed superheroes in all of the medium. So then, Batman then gets closer to the camp. We see they've got a bunch of cheetahs in cages because of course they do. And then they let loose the cheetahs. Batman has to escape being attacked by one of those. He knocks them out without having to kill it, luckily. Thank you. Because
the way I read it, the first one that attacks him, he's able to kick it toward the other one, so they're fighting each other.
Right. Yeah, they kind of pile on top of each other. Yeah. But yeah, that's true. Yeah. And so he manages to take off, and then he realizes, okay, I'm going to use a distraction to get these guys away. And he's thinking, is this even going to work? And of course it does, because these are henchmen. You're not getting necessarily the finest people in the world to do this job. And Batman even says something like, wow, I can't believe that worked. He's like, okay.
And this is the great thing about comics, using sound effects effectively. Because the first panel is a guy in the clearing with his gun, face in shadow, and the sound effect way above his head is Thresh.
Thresh.
Turns is A. Who's there? He approaches the jungle with his gun. And the next panel, you don't see anybody, but the sound effect is Kunch, and his word balloon is And I love it. I love the off-panel stuff like that, because we all know what Batman's doing. He's got the drop. He punched him or something. We don't have to see it every single time.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great, right. And if this was a movie, you would hear like the ping pong paddle hitting the couch, And that's what Indiana Jones would do when he punched that Nazi off screen. He just hear the psh, and then the hat flies up and
yeah, yes.
So Batman then manages to sneak in. There's a marvelous panel by Newton. I mean, these are all marvelous, but there's this great shot of Batman running with his face completely in shadow. And if, like, yes. if DC was doing cover corner boxes the way Marvel did, this would be your cover corner box because it's such an iconic shot of Batman running and looking mysterious. He manages to avoid getting shot by another.
Although Wonder he does Woman. Look like he's got Doctor Strange's old mask on.
Yeah, that's right. They have the face mask. The
or the mask. Tasmanian Devil.
That's it. Well, that's good too. He manages to again to evade getting shot by another one of the goons. He gets into the compound, and then immediately this trap door opens beneath him. He lands, and what do we see? A giant Jack in the Box, a giant squirting flower, and a giant
playing cards.
Giant bunch of playing cards. So it's just like, oh, of course. You know. And then we get our final page, which is a full shot of a throne and a, or sort of a pedestal, really. And Vicky Vale is trussed up, and Joker's even got the clown, happy and sad clown faces,
mm-hmm.
and a bunch of goons, and Joker is there in his full regalia, and they're about to get, and there's a train running in the background that will actually figure pretty heavily into the next issue because I remember what happens in that issue. That's the it for now. That's to be continued. And you know, I dare any kid who bought this comic to not plunk down 60 cents for Batman number 366 at this point.
It's great drama, great tension, great bat action, no nonsense bat action. It's overall, it's terrific. Great first part of a story.
It's wonderful. It's exciting. Batman, I bought this book for years. I continued buying it for years. And I mean, I was still buying it even to like the post-crisis era. So you're talking into the mid-80s, late 80s. I mean, geez, a black man. I mean, so yeah, I went for a long, Batman was always a regular purchase. And so, like I said, this was just something that I would have bought if I had been home, but I happened to be up in the Poconos and I bought it and I read this thing to death. And I read it, like you talked about, Terry, I read it a million times because it's so well done. Doug Minich just had a great run on Batman, as did Jerry Conway, who preceded him here.
Yeah.
But this is just, this whole era of Batman, I just think is just terrific.
See, and this is where it started to fall apart for me a little bit. I'm clicking now to see how much longer I was going to stick with it right up until the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And I was liking it less and less. And upon rereading it, I guess where I stopped in 85. Yeah, I don't remember buying these issues. I really find Doug Minch's writing tics annoying. Reading issue after issue right in a row, his Vicky Vale is such an annoying, whiny person. It's all very trite comic book romance stories. Oh, Bruce Wayne, I hate you so much. Throw the shot glass at the picture kind of stuff. I must leave Gotham. It really overwrought that way. Jason Todd is quite whiny. And I like Jason Todd, but the motivations to get Jason Todd to where he has to be Robin, spoiler, doesn't hold it for me, especially now as an old jaded reader. I like Joker's dialogue, but Mensch's captions in Oaf, the one that I hate the most in this particular issue, when Vicky's in the cage, she's been captured, she's in her cell. The captions read, "Deep under a Mayan pyramid in dank gloom, a video camera whirs. Vicky Vale mugs at it some 3 times per minute. So what, every 20 seconds she's looking at the camera making a face? And where's the other one? Oh, yes. On page 2, this is Doug's caption. Then, on her 7th snap of the shutter, the stillness is sharply shattered. Come on.
I like that alliteration there.
Yeah, it's kind of forcing it to have alliteration. You could just write, then, because the guys have drawn these guys running in, firing their guns. But reading 7 or 8 issues right in a row is... It became much more apparent. And then I was trying to figure out What is the time this is all happening? First of all, the train. Yeah, who takes a train from a town that doesn't exist in Indiana back to Gotham? How did he get there in the first place?
A town that doesn't exist in New Jersey.
Yeah. No, in Indiana.
I'm saying that the town in Indiana doesn't exist, but neither does Gotham City, which is in supposedly New Jersey.
But he makes a point of saying this is Zuma, Indiana, like it means something.
Right.
So is there an Amtrak station in Zuma? Did he have to go to Indianapolis? Did he go to Muncie? It's going to be a day's trip, right?
Yeah, it's a long trip. Again, yeah, it's a long trip.
You're right. He could charter a freaking airplane. He could get beamed up to the satellite, any number of things. So it's just, it's this trying to make it seem like a 1930s jungle movie. We got to have the hero on the train kind of thing. It's a very romantic notion for this. So Bruce and Jason go back to Gotham on the train. Maybe it's the super chief and it goes really fast. And they go home. Alfred's not there because Alfred has a different subplot happening right now, which is another one.
Yeah, he leaves a note saying, I have to leave Master Bruce, that thing.
So Bruce hasn't tried to call and say,
he's busy.
I'm on my way. Can you have some lunch ready?
He's busy fighting, as they mentioned, the Chimera in the previous issue. And
there's another piece of annoyance. That's not in this issue, but Chimera attacks Jason and says, I'm Chimera, pronounced Chimera.
As if so you know, everybody.
He's speaking in word balloons here.
Branding. He's got to do it. By the way, we were supposed to say Batman is also quite busy, having just formed Batman and the Outsiders.
Yeah.
So he is a very busy man.
But he's on the freaking train. It's going to stop in Cleveland. He can make a call from Cleveland. At least leave a message. So he knows. And Alfred, so that's something else happening. But they get home. They get called to the hospital. Why there aren't 15 other cops visiting Gordon at the time, it's just for a plot for convenience sake. I forget if at this time Babs still knew who Bruce and Dick were, or if they tried to retcon that away and re-retcon it. I forget what they did. They messed it up, and that annoyed me. She knew who they were. In the bit with Harvey's, now they're making him into a better character. Yeah, and Bruce gets information. So somehow this Japanese tourist knows, okay, there's a woman in trouble. Here's a piece of paper. He gets it to somebody. The bus driver, maybe. Maybe he finds an English speaker on the bus. It's 50 miles back to a city. It's a long frickin' bus ride in those roads. This person has to find, an Associated Press stringer someplace? Say, I got a message for Picture News in Gotham. It's just the speed with which that message gets through. And then the speed with which Batman gets down to Guatemala and finds the place. But what's more annoying is even more incomprehensive speed of how next issue Jason gets there.
Well, that's for a different podcast.
That's for a different podcast.
It was to cover Batman number 366.
Reading all of these instead of, every 2 weeks when they were published, Batman Detective. Those things really stuck out to me. And I remember back at then, I was excited. I love Jerry Conway's stories. And I was excited for this mensch guy from Marvel coming over, even though I did not like Moon Knight at all. And I know I'm probably in the minority, but Thief of the Night, Nocturna, hated them, still hate them, think it's terrible. And the subplot we get later with Nocturna and Jason, absolutely awful. And that's what really drove me away. It got too tritely soap opera-ish. Okay. Even though there had been some great soap opera stuff happening ever since Conway was doing it. That's a different rant.
I'm looking at the cover gallery in Mike's Amazing World of Batman because I was sort of curious, how long did I read Batman in a row? And I see that I started reading it in the 290s and got it every month, and then I kept going.
You started about the same time.
All the way until Batman 431. That's the last one I bought, and I did not get it after that. So I read Batman every single month. I mean, there might have been a month here or two where, like, I just didn't find it or whatever. But I basically read Batman for 130 issues straight. Hmm. That is, wow. I mean, and
now, despite, I almost got that far. Now I'm looking back. I must have kept, I must have kept buying it. Didn't like it as much.
Well, right. Yeah. I mean,
and I do not like Tom Mandrake. I didn't like, never liked his work at all. I know a lot of people love him.
I'm not going to have that on this show, Terry.
Sorry, man. It's not. Just too, proportions just were all over the place then. And I was buying it. Yeah. Then that stupid issue happened. I think I missed those two. I got Batman Year One. And then I kept going, and then that awful new Jason Todd showed up, and that was the stupidest story. And then I stopped buying, and the stories got stupider.
Despite the fact that I helped kill him off, I did not like Death in the Family. And so we see that those, two more issues after Death in the Family, I finally bailed on the book. So
I have not read it, but I've heard, I remember, I listened to the Overlook Dark Knight talk about it and dissect it. And just the story beats alone don't make any freaking sense.
I don't want to go down that road. The show is supposed to be positive. Yeah,
this is positive because this is we read a great Batman story. Yeah, comic.
This was great. All the Batman comics that I bought for all those years up in the Poconos were always just fantastic through this whole run. It just were. And this one was just such a delight to read. And it's a complete, again, it's part of a story, but it's also a complete meal. It's got a beginning, middle, and end.
Really Don Newton on Batman and Gene Colan on Detective. Oh man,
that's a killer combo.
Yeah,
that is good stuff. That is absolutely good stuff. So that is Batman number 365, everybody. So Terry, thank you so much for coming to the cabin. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It's terrific.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
I'm Ward Hill Terry on a couple of the more prominent social media platforms. Whatever name they go by these days. I don't comment and post much. I do most stuff on Facebook. And I got my rock and roll band, Stop Calling Me Frank. We have our Facebook page. We have a TwitX account. We have, what else we got? I don't post nearly enough stuff to Threads and Instagram. And, of course, we're on Bandcamp on Rumbar Records. You can get our stuff there. And if you're in the Boston area, come see our shows.
All right. Very cool. Again, Terry, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, and we're going to be in New York in November. So friends in New York.
Oh, my. Okay. Where are you going to be playing?
I forget the name of the place.
Okay.
Someplace down in lower Manhattan and someplace out past JFK.
Okay. All right. We'll go to the website. You can find out, everybody.
So, that's right.
Again, Terry, thank you so much. Thank you so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure is all mine, Rob.
All right, everybody. So thanks so much for listening. Of course, you can subscribe to this show on any podcatcher of your choice. You can find us on Twitter at FWPMountain.com. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, just go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on the show of your choice. So big thanks to David S. Gutierrez and Gord Tolton for their support of the Fine Water Podcast Network. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Terry and I are going to drink some Yoo-Hoo and talk about Batman comics as the sun goes down here on the porch. And we will see you next month. Bye.
Have a summer of fun in the Poconos. At your host with the most in the Poconos.
Every kind of summer fun at Mount Airy Lodge or Pocono Gardens. Beautiful rooms, fabulous food, headline entertainment. Winter, spring, summer, fall. Call 966-7210 for reservations at Pocono Gardens and
beautiful Mount Airy Lodge.